Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. And today we're going to be talking with jazz radio host, retired but esteemed, and jazz historian Dennis Owsley about a lot of things, with a main emphasis on the great city of St. Louis and its contributions to jazz. Welcome, Dennis.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's going to be fun.
And Dennis, you had a major milestone recently. Less than a month ago, you retired after 36 years on KWMU, which is the public radio station for St. Louis.
Exactly. I was held the fort down for a long time, and in the process, went from using LPs to CDs to digital things, recording it at home, and taking in digital files, and also wrote two books on St. Louis jazz.
Great. We're going to definitely talk about those. Now, we have listeners from all over the world, and we have some listeners that may never have left the East or West Coast. For the sake of those people, let's place St. Louis in space, in geography. How would you describe St. Louis's location to somebody that's not familiar with it?
St. Louis is just south of the confluence of the Mississippi and Missouri rivers. It's about, if you're going from the east, it's about a third of the way across the country, and due south of Lake Michigan, a long ways due south, but due south. And it's on the Mississippi River.
And not exactly in the geographical center of the country, but getting pretty close.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what that location, let's start with history first, before we get to the current scene in St. Louis. What did that location mean for St. Louis as a city? What influences would it have been exposed to by virtue of being in that place? And what kind of people settled in St. Louis?
Well, French and Germans settled in St. Louis. And St. Louis is unique in some ways because the influences of the music come and go in an east-west manner. From the railroads, used to be a railroad hub, and of course, up and down the river to Davenport, Iowa, from New Orleans. So influences come and go. The thing about St. Louis is that there is what you would call no definable style in St. Louis, but it was a hotbed for two major things that contributed to jazz. Two roots, blues. The first published blues was actually published in St. Louis, Baby Seal Blues, 3 months before W.C. Handy's Memphis Blues, and then also Ragtime with the Ragtime people. And the king of Ragtime, by the way, was not in St. Louis, was not Scott Joplin, but was Tom Turpin.
Hmm. And you mentioned that the city was settled primarily by French and German people. And I know the one time I've been to St. Louis, I was amazed at how many fleur-de-lis I saw. I can remember seeing them embedded in the sidewalk. They were everywhere.
Right.
And of course, the city had a large African-American population. Would that have been people that moved up from the South, or would they have been people that were there all along? Like, you know, in other words, it was a great migration. Yeah.
The great migration came through, some of them came through St. Louis. Most of them kept going.
Okay.
Because it was very much like the South. And so they felt that it would be better to go on to Chicago, where things were a little bit better. Not much, but a little bit better.
Gotcha. So culturally, in those days, it was more of it had sort of a Southern feeling?
It still does.
Still does, okay.
I was born and raised in the Los Angeles area, and I took a job in St. Louis in 1969 with Monsanto. In addition to being a radio person, I'm a scientist. I have a PhD in organic chemistry.
Ah, okay.
And I took a job there in 1969, and I thought, my God, I've moved to Alabama.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
And historically, I don't know, was Missouri a slave state?
It was a free state, but really was half slave, half free.
Okay.
Of course, the Dred Scott decision took place in St. Louis, and
what
the
did?
Old courthouse is the site of that decision. You can still see that in St. Louis.
And for people that don't know the history, could you tell us briefly about the Dred Scott decision and what it did?
That was a decision where I believe, I may be wrong, but I'm 76 years old.
Yeah.
I don't have quite as sharp memory as I do. But anyway, Dred Scott was a slave who escaped and I believe was married to a free woman. And they captured him and the trial was held in St. Louis, and I know he was sent back to slavery.
I see. Yeah, and that was, I'm looking it up too. And it was 1957 and
1857.
Excuse me. 1857. though things took a long time to change.
Right.
And the case went on for 10 years, it looks like.
Wow.
And the issue was that he had been brought to a free state and thought, hey, why am I an enslaved person in a free state? And I guess the court in St. Louis upheld it, which I guess says a little bit about the social character of St. Louis in those days.
Well, there's still a situation where there's two Missouris, really. There's a rural Missouri and a urban Missouri. And the city of St. Louis, basically, up until a long time, was controlled literally by the governor and legislature in Jefferson City. We didn't get our police and fire districts away from the government until the 1990s.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a strange arrangement
yes.
for the rural area, for the rural population to literally control the urban area. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, America is it's a diverse place in more ways than one. I guess that's
right.
Political structures and social configurations. Now, what you wrote you've got two books out.
Right.
If I'm correct, it's one is St. Louis Jazz and History.
That's the latest one.
Yep. And that came out, it looks like, in July. And mm-hmm. then you have another book, City of Gabriels, The History of Jazz in St. Louis, 1895 to 1973. Now, you have pointed out that St. Louis has a particularly important role in the development of the trumpet.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Of course, everybody should know Miles Davis off just the top of their head, but I'm sure it's deeper than Miles.
Well, one of the things about St. Louis is the fact that there are a number of trumpeters that go way back, and they have an identifiable sound that evolves through time. And you can, if you've got a good ear, you can spot a St. Louis trumpeter.
Huh.
So one of the first things that you need to know is that early on, if you were a trumpet player, you got your lessons from a German teacher. So one of the characteristics of the sound is a singing sound with not so much the vibrato as, say, in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets even less vibrato as you go up the river toward Davenport, Iowa, which is really a German area. And the first progenitor, I guess, of the sound is a man by the name of Charles Kreth. And everybody patterned themselves after him. And the other thing about the St. Louis sound is that most all of the trumpet players used a Heim, H-E-Y-M, mouthpiece that was prescribed by a man by the name of Joseph Gustat, who was an Italian, but took a German name so that he could be the first trumpet principal trumpet of the symphony.
Uh-huh,
he had a music store, and anybody that wanted to come in there and get stuff could, black, white, didn't matter. And he prescribed this mouthpiece. So early on in the 20s, you have people like Kreth and Dewey Jackson and a number of others, including early on in the late 20s, early 30s, a man by the name of Harold Shorty Baker, who was a trumpet player with Duke Ellington for years. And another one by the name of Clark Terry. I'm sure you know that
mm-hmm,
name.
Mm-hmm.
And after Clark, there was Miles and a few in between. And after Miles, there is Lester Bowie.
Oh, the great Lester Bowie, yeah.
And after Lester Bowie, there is Keon Harold.
Mm.
And Russell Gunn from the East Side in between. And that's only about half the well-known trumpet players that have come out of St. Louis.
Hmm. Yeah, I just have to pay tribute to Lester Bowie. I think he was certainly acknowledged and respected and admired, but I think very underrated as a technician and trumpet player. I thought he was unbelievable. His mastery.
I knew him actually.
Oh, you did.
Yes, I did. And he was really a funny guy, really a funny, funny guy. Had a great sense of humor and been very, very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that there was no sound that he heard that he couldn't make on trumpet. His father was a well-known brass teacher who brought him to St. Louis in the late 50s. His father taught him in St. Louis schools.
And so they moved to St. Louis from somewhere else?
Maryland.
From Maryland. And, of course, Joseph, who I had a chance to meet and hear Joseph play a lot in New York in the, I guess it was 70s. And I thought he was one of the greatest trombone players of all time.
He's not bad.
I mean, he got more... He was so expressive with the trombone. It was just I thought it was breathtaking every time I heard him. We often hear the AACM, and of course Joseph Bowie was Lester was part of the art ensemble, which some people might think that's an entirely Chicago invention, but Lester's from St. Louis,
right.
So going back go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you please.
One of the things about the art ensemble is that they dressed up in these interesting costumes, but the music was not all that wild.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty straight ahead. If you listen to it and close your eyes and just listen to it, funny sounds, stuff like that, but boy, straight ahead, and it was well put together.
One
of the things that I found out, because I interviewed Roscoe Mitchell, was that the Art Ensemble, before they went on tour, went to a place in Oregon for 30 days and rehearsed for 30 days. So nothing that they did, while it looked like free jazz, was free jazz. It was rehearsed to the T.
Okay.
And that's one of the things that is, I think, really a legend that should be dismantled about free jazz. All of these free jazz players rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed before they ever went out and played in public.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're rehearsing and one of the people that you're playing with goes bleep, you know that you've got to go either blat, blat, or bloop, you know.
Uh-huh. I had the unique, I think it's a fairly unique experience of getting to watch Ornette Coleman rehearse for 6 to 8 hours. And I also, in a totally separate occasion, had the chance to see Cecil Taylor rehearse for around 6 to 8 hours. And I can testify they weren't fooling around.
No.
They worked things out very carefully with a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of thought. We did an interview, by the way. I don't know if you know the book, but you probably do, Message to Our Folks, The Art Ensemble of Chicago by Paul Steinbeck. And if people want to dig deeper into that whole art ensemble experience and how that group was put together, you can. That's one way to do it.
Right.
So going back to the City of Gabriels, you start in 1895, which is, that's pretty much proto-jazz or pre-jazz.
Well, yeah, because one of the things I think is that it's kind of all one continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And St. Louis was a hotbed for both jazz and blues. Two of the roots of jazz, now, think about that. So you had Tom Turpin, who published the first African-American rag, not Scott Joplin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the guy that ran the Rose Bud Cafe and had his piano up on blocks because he was such a big guy. And so he was a big influence. One of the things about Scott Joplin, he lived here in St. Louis from about 1898 or something like that till about 1908. But most of the time he spent composing or on the road with his opera. And it was not Tremonitia, it was another one, and I forget the name of it. But it was he was not one that played out apparently as much in St. Louis as people would like to believe. And he did not appear at the World's Fair.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And no ragtime. And here's something that's interesting, that there was no ragtime allowed on the World's Fair except on the Midway. And the newspapers called it sinful music, and the city fathers were not going to allow that sinful music to be played on the World's Fairgrounds. Except that there was a socialite from New York by the name of Dory Lyon, I believe, who did a ragtime demonstration on the fairgrounds. I guess if you're white, you're okay to play ragtime on there.
Uh-huh.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a music form in Cuba called son, S-O-N, and it was it had the same reputation that it was low life and terrible, and couldn't have it in polite society until the president of the country would have son bands play for him, and that changed the perspective. It's interesting how music goes through these phases where it's a new style is demonized as if it's, some devil's spawn or something. We have to be protected from it. And then later, decades later, we're scratching our head wondering what was the problem.
Yeah, well, I grew up in L.A., and I heard the original Ornette Coleman Quartet. Wow. And I thought, my God, what the heck is that? And now it just sounds quaint.
Right.
It just sounds quaint.
Yeah. You can hear, you know, now, and I have kind of the same experience the first time I heard it, but it was on record. And now I listen, and it just sounds like absolutely in the zone, traditional roots, all American jazz.
Yeah, the other thing that you might do is listen to, all of a sudden, the Johnson, the great blues singer from the 30s.
Uh-huh.
His cadences are almost the same as Ornette's.
Interesting. And his last name's Johnson?
Yeah. Not Lonnie Johnson. Hellhound on My Trail is the thing that you ought to listen to. It's in the Riverside collection of classic jazz. I know that. But if you listen to his cadences, a lot of Ornette Coleman's cadences sound pretty close to his.
Wow. Robert Johnson.
Yeah, Robert Johnson. Right.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I found, and you may be aware of this, but I love to tell people, these are listeners, that Ornette's first professional gig outside of Fort Worth was in Amarillo, and it was at a black nightclub. But in the evenings, in the late night, he would do, after-hours sessions with a hillbilly steel blues guitar player at age 19. Yeah, I'll send you the details on that. Yeah, it's in a very interesting book on Texas music. So going back to the 95 as the starting point, what was, you know, we don't have recordings from that, unfortunately, but we have sheet music and we have people's memories, and then we have music.
There actually are piano rolls.
There's a
Scott Joplin piano roll or two that were recorded in St. Louis in 1902 or three.
Okay.
And it turns out that Joplin didn't really have a lot of chops, as far as I'm concerned, compared to his contemporary. He had a lot of composing chops, but not maybe piano chops.
Yeah, you can't have it all, you know. So we have St. Louis at the sort of midway between, roughly, between Chicago and New Orleans, getting influence from all directions, also getting influence from the West, and that's something that we've been looking into a lot in the last year, how much great music came out of Oklahoma and Kansas and Texas. So St. Louis got that influence too, and I'm sure it got the Eastern influence when musicians would pass through and play.
Right.
So it was a real crossroads musically.
Yeah, in fact, if you wanted to get a gig with a band, you just went to St. Louis and waited until somebody came through. Yeah.
Interesting.
It was known as a place to get picked up by well-known bands. And in fact, let's see. Well-known bass player got picked up by King Oliver's Dixie Syncopators in St. Louis in 1927. And all of a sudden, I can't remember the name of the bass player.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So you know, the myth of jazz, and I use that word specifically, is that it started in New Orleans and sailed up the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not to take anything away from New Orleans, because obviously it was a hotbed of creativity, and it probably produced numerically maybe more jazz musicians at that time than any other place.
Right.
It still is a great jazz center. It still is producing great jazz musicians and having an enormous influence in every possible way. But it's possible that jazz really developed in a different way than starting in New Orleans and sailing up the river. Could you comment on that and tell us your feelings about it?
We had a guy here in St. Louis by the name of Gus Perriman. He's a pianist, and he was born someplace in Alabama around 1900. And he early on, had piano lessons and was working very early on, and traveling by the time he was a teenager, playing a kind of a proto-jazz. And he traveled all over the South. And one of the things that people don't seem to realize is that ideas seem to arise spontaneously, but in different places. And I want to give you a couple of examples. The first one is the periodic table. And that one, it was first published in Russia in the 1870s or 1880s by a man by the name of Mendeleev. But there was another guy in Indonesia and another guy in Russia who published within days of Mendeleev.
Wow. And did you say Indonesia?
Yes.
What an unlikely place in those days.
And there's no connection between those places.
No.
Sonny Stitt and Charlie Parker.
Uh-huh.
Sound very much alike, and they both appeared on the scene at about the same time. Sonny in Boston, Bird in Kansas City.
Mm.
So a lot of this stuff that you're talking about has to do with evolution of thoughts and human brains.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily separate. We're not, you know, on some level, perhaps indescribable now. We are connected. Well, Carl Jung, the great, you know, psychologist, always talked about, what was that? He talked about the collective unconscious.
Right.
That beyond the consciousness of individuals, there was this other consciousness that was sort of out there that people could tap into from different parts of the world at different times. And, you know, whether we can scientifically establish that or not, it shows up again and again and again in history. You know, for instance, I think Buddha and Lao Tzu and some other famous spiritual thinkers all basically lived roughly the same time, had very similar ideas, and yet they were separated by thousands of miles, and we haven't seen anything like that since.
No.
Yeah.
You know, it may be evolution, it may be a conscious, collective consciousness, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's there, and we cannot deny that.
So another model for jazz is that there was a music culture, and a lot of people were tapping into it. And I think one thing that we can't imagine these days because of the nature of the society we have now is how dominant live music was in people's lives. If there was going to be music, the only way you could hear it pre-recording was if people were playing it, which meant for music to exist, there had to be a deep culture, schooling, education, summer bands in the park, and parade bands, and firemen's bands, and just
right.
Thousands of varieties of musical expression that we can't even imagine today.
Well, one of the things that I know very well is that, you know, we had this, a lot of the early history of jazz was written by foreigners. Very liberal politically foreigners. And one of the things that they had in the back of their minds was this idea of primitivism.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, these black people, and actually if you really look around, there's Italians involved in it from the very first too, were so primitive that they could pick up a horn and play anything.
Mm-hmm.
Except that that's not true.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Just talking about just here, and if you read the biographies of all of the major jazz people, and I think I have, most all of them had music lessons as children.
Yep.
They didn't. This was not any primitive thing.
Yep.
Where they just had this ability, but were you aware that in the 20s that the black bands rehearsed with paper and then played, memorized it and played on the stand with no paper, because if they had a piece of paper up there, they couldn't get a job.
Yeah, showbiz. Yeah. Showbiz. And there's one other piece to this, and maybe you can tell me if somebody has studied this, because if not, it needs to be studied. These young musicians, when they got their usually piano lessons, were largely trained by women.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
So without those women laying down the foundation, because a good teacher makes all the difference. A bad music teacher could ruin somebody musically for life. So, and conversely, a good music teacher could open somebody up for life. So there's a generation, and I'm trying to place it like if the musicians were coming to the fore in the 20s, that means they were in their 20s. So all this was happening in the, you know, they were getting their piano lessons in the 1910s, which meant we're talking about the generation of people who were just one generation away from slavery.
Right. And the other thing that I think is true, not only was it women who were doing the piano teaching, but if you look at centers for jazz that kind of popped up in the 20s and 30s, mm-hmm. there was one person or two people that kind of led the charge, including a woman by the name of Zelia Breaux in Oklahoma City.
Oh, okay.
And out from her comes Don Byas, Charlie Christian, and Jay McCann.
Wow.
And you look at L.A., a man by the name of Sam Brown and Ernie Royal's brother. St. Louis is interesting in that it had a whole tassel of classically trained music teachers in the schools, which is very different. But Chicago had Major Ian Clark Smith and Walter Diet.
Mm-hmm.
In Detroit, it was the high school, one of the high schools there, Westinghouse High School in Pittsburgh. You know, so it's like one spot almost that draws these people in and teaches them.
And speaking of, we were speaking of Ornette earlier, there was a school like that in Fort Worth, and Dewey Redmond went there, and Prince Lachey went there. It's so, and this goes to your point, this is not some spontaneous, you know, primitive, untutored explosion of creativity, native genius. This is, a disciplined art form, and there were men and women who dedicated their lives to, you know, passing musical skill on to the younger generation. That's why we have these great jazz musicians.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I really believe that, you know, and we have a situation in St. Louis that stubbornly refuses to believe that. Mm. This is the Dixieland crowd.
Mm-hmm.
St. Louis is very much of a, as time goes on, the Dixieland people are beginning to die out. But, I mean, they would very stubbornly believe that, A, the music on the riverboats, excursion boats, was jazz. When, in fact, in my first book, I went into great detail on it. Three or four people saying that, no, the Streckfest people bought the arrangements. They gave them to the band leaders. The band leaders rehearsed against the clock. They had 14, I think, new pieces every 2 weeks, and they had to memorize them, read them and memorize them and play them. Mm-hmm. And if they were more than a little bit off in their timing, they got fined. Even in their rehearsals, if their time was off for the pieces. And people around St. Louis, just in that group anyway, just seemed to not hear that. Mm. And I think the name William Howland Smith wrote a book on jazz and the riverboats, and he called them red hot dance bands.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And even though the players in there were jazz players, but they came out of those things, which were known at the time as floating conservatories, And they came out of those things cracked music readers.
And because they were compelled to step up their reading ability,
yeah,
and their musicianship and then their professional. I think Louis Armstrong talked about that in his bio, how important his time on those boats was.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, and every musician needs that. They need a place where they can play a lot, where standards are high. We did a piece recently on Eddie Durham, his opportunity was playing for the circuses, the traveling circuses, and those were huge enterprises and very important musically way back when.
An awful lot of the St. Louis early players ended up in circuses too.
Mm-hmm.
I know that. Yeah.
Well, if you think, you know, before TV, before movies really were, you know, everywhere, before, you know, when radio was still pretty primitive, record players, you know, people don't realize that. My understanding is that with the record player, the needle would wear out after five songs in the old days. So you couldn't play your music incessantly unless you could afford a lot of needles. So
I think those things were cactus barbs.
So if music was going to be live, you know, back to something I was saying earlier, and the circus was this amazing spectacle. People from other parts of the country, other parts of the world, all kinds of amazing music, tricks, and acrobats, you had to have music to make it work. Imagine a circus without music. I mean, it's impossible.
Right.
So endless amounts of playing opportunities and learning opportunities. Hey, there's an important piece of St. Louis history that I think is even maybe edited out of St. Louis, but it's very important for the cultural history. Is the maybe you could talk a little bit about the riots of East St. Louis and the effect those had on.
Yes. In 1917, there was a great fear that the blacks coming up from the South during the Great Migration were going to take all the jobs in the slaughterhouses in East St. Louis. And so they started going around and beating and killing black people. I don't know exactly how many people were killed, but there were three instances in 1917 of riots that went on for a week, that the cops finally would tamp down, or the National Guard would tamp down, and they'd leave and they'd start up again. And one of the things that is very apparent from Miles Davis and others, that the black community in St. Louis and East St. Louis has never, ever, ever forgotten those riots.
And that was part of something that was going on all over the country in that period.
Yep.
And it's something that's been written out of our history and our understanding. And, you know, it's formative, and it's one of the many, huge obstacles that African-American musicians had to overcome, that mm-hmm. kind of a society. But you make a point that the origins of jazz really are maybe a lot, not only geographically varied, but culturally varied, more varied than the standard history gives credit for.
One of the things that, if you just sit down and list all of the well-known trumpet players that came out of New Orleans around the 1910s to the 1915, say, it turns out that one third of them were Italians.
Mm.
Now, I've run across some things which indicate that the Italians were just as despised as the black people were down there in New Orleans at the time.
Yep.
They kind of seemed to live in the same neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
So one of the things that Gerald Early always teaches in his classes, and he and I have discussed this, is that whites had always been involved in jazz from the very beginning. And one of the things that I like to think about jazz, there's two things that I think about jazz that I think are very important for people to recognize. Jazz may be the only true democracy in this country, because everybody, once you get on the band, everybody gets a solo. Everybody gets recognized for their contributions. And then the second thing is, it's also a meritocracy. Lester Young used to say, you can join the throng when you sing your own song. And if you look at that, with the exception of a period of in the 60s where black nationalism was really big, anybody, if they could play, could play. Mm-hmm. And they didn't care whether you were black or white or rich or poor or anything else. And one of the things, a couple of things that I know of from the history of work that I did in St. Louis was that there were interracial jam sessions at a place called the Chauffeurs Club that the police kind of looked the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Spiderbeck and Frank Trumbauer and Pee Wee Russell all hung out with a lot of the black jazz musicians over on the east side on their Monday nights. Oh, when they were off, they all went over there and chased the same women and did all of that over a place called Katy Ridge. In the Booker T. Washington Theater in 1914, the patron said to the owner at the time, which was Tom Turpin's brother, we're sick and tired of this minstrel stuff, and if you can't get high-class white acts, we're going to pressure you to bring in white acts.
Mm-hmm.
They did. And in 1926, Dick Spiderbeck, Frank Trumbauer, and Pee Wee Russell, I believe, two of those three, and maybe all three, played on stage at a benefit at the Booker T. Washington Theater with the Charles Kreft Band.
Wow.
Now, you listen to Ken Burns' film, and Margot Jefferson says that Dick Spiderbeck would have been a better trumpet player had he played with blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And in Louis Armstrong's own words in his autobiography, he tells the story in Chicago, when he was playing the theaters in Chicago. Spiderbeck and those guys from the Friar Society Orchestra would come into the theater where Louis was playing. They would close the doors and jam all night long. And
yep.
Why that was in that Ken Burns film, I don't know, but boy, I just about hit the ceiling when I heard that.
Yeah, it's good we get this history out. I mean, and the music really was created throughout its entire history in two places, one on the dance floor, but also after the dance when the musicians got together. And, you know, who knew Ornette Coleman did late night jam sessions with a hillbilly steel blue guitar. And you mentioned Frank Trumbauer and Lester Young, who we mentioned earlier, was a huge fan of Frank Trumbauer. Like, it was very clear that he learned the essence of how to tell a story from Trumbauer's music.
And
so there was a tremendous back and forth always, though it took a while for it to become, widespread.
They didn't let it, well, it wasn't well known to the authorities, shall we say.
For young people listening to this, and I know in New Orleans it was a jailable offense to be a white person in a black environment or vice versa in an entertainment environment. Hey, one thing about Italian, I'm going to say, people were probably Sicilian And there's a reason that that's significant. One is that Sicily, before Florida and Texas started growing citrus, was sort of the major place where citrus was grown. So there were a lot of boats going between New Orleans and Sicily carrying citrus. And so Sicily, which was devastated economically, then, I mean, it was as down as it could. The people, the regular working people, were just in a horrific condition in the late 1800s and early 1900s. A lot of them got on the boat and went to New Orleans. And yes, they were not welcome by white society. The biggest lynching that ever took place in New Orleans was actually of Sicilians. Numerically. Yeah, in one day, you know, in one event. And now what was interesting is the Sicilians didn't understand what the problem was. So when they opened their fish stores and their produce stores, they served everybody, which was not the case in New Orleans. And then the other thing which is missing, and I hope somebody someday will take this up, is if you go to Sicily, they have a very well-established parade, funeral band tradition, and brass, by the way, and they wear the uniforms that the old school brass bands used to wear in New Orleans. So I'm thinking that, you know, that part of that tradition in New Orleans was adopted by African Americans from their Sicilian friends. And the last piece of this, which is so interesting, is there's a tradition down there called Mardi Gras Indians, which is a whole long story. They celebrate two sacred days. One is Mardi Gras, of course, but the other one is St. Joseph's Day, which is a Sicilian festival. So why are African Americans celebrating a Sicilian festival? It has to be because when the Sicilians came over, they were all friends, and they were sharing music and food and conversation. And then not to go too far off on this, but even rock and roll, Cosimo Matassa, a Sicilian grocer, was the first man to really record rock and roll in a big way. And black musicians really weren't invited into recording studios in New Orleans, but this Sicilian didn't see any problem with it. And he was recording Little Richard and Fats Domino and Chuck Berry and sort of launched rock and roll. So there's a lot of Italian, African-American cultural communication over the decades.
Right.
Hey, let's talk about St. Louis today, the scene today, because we have a lot of people that like to visit the U.S., and I always tell people, well, you have to go to New York, of course, and you probably should go to New Orleans, but there's a lot of cities in America that still have good jazz scenes. What can you tell us about the St. Louis scene and what people should look for if they visit?
St. Louis has one of the best, probably top five, maybe top two, jazz clubs in the world right now with jazz at the Bistro. And it's called, the organization is called Jazz St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a huge educational component to that club, which is just a wonderful place to go to. You can't believe the sound in that place. But they, over the years, have touched 160,000 children with their in-school things that they do. One of the things that I always did when I was there before they got the new place was I always drove the musicians to their school opportunities. And one of the rules that you have to follow when you play there is that you will do a in-school clinic.
Uh-huh.
Now they can bring three and four schools down for a clinic, and every traveling group that's there always gets a clinic, and it doesn't matter who that person is, how famous they are or not famous, they will get a clinic from those guys and women.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wow, so they're really planting the seeds.
That. So that is one of the things. Now, the other thing that is interesting there is that we have a small but very good jazz education department at Webster University in Webster Groves, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And they have concerts during the school year about every other Monday night. And those, some of those concerts here almost approach the skill of the great traveling musicians that we get. And I think I'll tell you something that I heard that it still actually kind of makes me choke up. Their big band was doing a concert on Mingus.
Mm-hmm.
With Mingus's stuff. No, it's not, you know, Mingus's big band stuff or Mingus's compositions are not easy.
No, not to do well.
And these are kids, right? You know,
yeah.
18 to 21, 22 years old. And it was like the ghost of Mingus showed up.
Wow. Beautiful.
And they played so far over their heads.
Beautiful. Oh. And then, of course,
unbelievable.
And can you tell us the name? Can you tell us the name of that school again for people?
Okay, it's Webster University.
Webster University.
In Webster Groves, Missouri. Now, the Washington University has a place called my 76-year-old brain suddenly Holmes Lounge.
Okay.
Where they have weekly jazz concerts all year long. And they're mostly local people, but they have some national people coming in. University of Missouri St. Louis has a jazz department now. Jim Widener, for a long time, headed the music and big band part of it, and he retired, and they've gone to a full-blown jazz department. St. Louis U has jazz courses. The problem with St. Louis is that there are very few other places to go for jazz besides these places. And the clubs in general have no idea how to advertise. So a club will start, and they won't advertise. They won't even let anybody know they're there. And so it'll happen for over 3 or 4 weeks or 5 weeks, and then boom, it's gone. And so there's a place called BB's Jazz Blues and Soups, which occasionally has jazz. But in general, the people that want to start these clubs seem to have no business sense at all.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if it's any worse anyplace else, but that's an interesting problem. The other interesting problem is that St. Louis has is what I call a tall poppy syndrome.
Hmm.
It's known as something that actually is a saying that comes from Australia. And if you are a St. Louis artist, and it doesn't matter what kind of an artist you are, if you never leave St. Louis, you aren't worth anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you go to New York and come back, you're a gigantic star.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you're probably just as good a musician, there are many musicians or artists just as good as you are. You will never get the recognition. They do not, except for the symphony, they do not recognize their local artists at all.
Uh-huh.
That's a tragedy.
I've
written about that in both of my books.
Okay, great. Great. So if people want to know, and I think people are getting the sense now that St. Louis, if they're doing a jazz tour of America and they want to visit, you know, in jazz cities, you know, if, especially if they're already in the middle of the country, they should definitely check out St. Louis. And so your books,
right.
And I want to mention the titles again, the newest one, St. Louis Jazz and History, and then City of Gabriel's, which is a sort of a, would we call it a coffee table book?
It's a coffee table. It's a sneaky book that is a very, academic.
Okay.
Academic book.
So it's got a
got 750 references in it.
Okay. So it's got a pretty face, but it's also erudite.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And now, which book, if someone had to pick one, which book would be the best for getting a sense of today's scene in St. Louis? Or are they both
The second one. It's still in print, as far as I know.
City of Gabriel?
Yeah. No. The first one was City of Gabriel. The second one is St. Louis Jazz, a History.
Yep.
Unfortunately, the publisher wanted to do the whole thing in 45,000 words, and 35,000, and I finally got them up to 45,000 words.
Mm.
And so in some ways it's kind of a shotgun, but it really hits the highlights of St. Louis jazz and gives, I think, a pretty complete picture of the entire history. And you'll find all kinds of interesting things about jazz St. Louis and Jazz the Bistro. I mean, again, if you only could advertise in the paper or wherever, you'd be a success.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz St. Louis, the Jazz at the Bistro was started by a lady by the name of Barbara Rose way back in 1990 as Jazz at the Majestic. And then she had to move to where the Jazz at the Bistro is now. And she passed in 1998, and every week you saw two or three ads, and every week the place was packed.
Mm.
And then you had Gene Dobbs Bradford became the editor, and he and Bob Bennett and others have done this fantastic job. And like I say, 160,000 kids being affected by jazz, can't be wrong.
No, what a wonderful thing. So we've been talking with Dennis Owsley, and the author of two books, City of Gabriels, and most recently, St. Louis Jazz, A History, the most up-to-date. And you can get a brand new spanking version of that from Amazon. You can also, if you're an electronics book reader, they have a Kindle version. So this book is most definitely available, very highly rated on Amazon. And again, let's broaden our perspective and realize that jazz came from a lot of different places and a lot of different people. And Dennis is one of the people making that story clear and also shining a bright light on an important area, important city in the jazz tradition, St. Louis. Dennis, thanks so much for writing these books and for all you've done to educate us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to do this. I love talking about jazz. That's it. It's been a really great time.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.